A landmark decision from the United States Supreme Court about gender transition treatments for minors. The White House weighs a potential U.S. military role in the tensions between Israel and Iran. Happiness expert and professor Arthur Brooks discusses Pope Leo's mission of love. And two Catholic writers join us to talk about the growing belief that now Catholicism is cool. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Great win for democracy. I mean, this case really says that the elected representatives of the people of Tennessee and not federal judges are the ones who ought to be making these policy calls.
Tennessee's Attorney General Jonathan Scrimeti celebrates a win at the U.S. Supreme Court with a case centered on gender transitions for minors. It's one of many across the nation we're closely following. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's right to protect minors with gender dysphoria from transition procedures like puberty blockers and so-called hormone therapy. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Three Tennessee families and a doctor originally challenged the state law. The Biden administration joined them, arguing the law discriminated based on sex in violation of the 14th Amendment. Tennessee insisted the law distinguishes based on a treatment's medical purpose, not sex. In a 6-3 decision, the high court ruled Tennessee's ban on gender transition procedures for minors can remain in place because it does not amount to sex discrimination. Scrimeti says the decision protects minors from experimental procedures. Many in the LGBTQ community argue they have a right to make their own medical decisions.
This is about parental rights, and this is about taking away the rights of families and parents and caregivers from making those decisions with their doctors, with their families.
If you look at countries that actually follow the evidence, as the Tennessee legislature did, you see countries like the United Kingdom and Sweden and Norway, which are very politically different than Tennessee, who came to this conclusion not as a result of a culture war, but because they want to protect their kids, and they have seen evidence that these radical interventions cause lifelong harm, there's huge risk, and very little, if any, benefit shown by the research.
25 other states across the U.S. have similar protections against using life-altering hormones and puberty blockers to treat gender dysphoria in minors. These controversial treatments are still available in states without the ban. The Catholic Church is clear gender transition is a grave violation of human dignity. The Vatican document Dignitas Infinita, or Infinite Dignity, which was released last year, states in part, we are called to protect our humanity. And this means, in the first place, accepting it and respecting it as it was created. It follows that any sex change intervention, as a rule, risks threatening the unique dignity the person has received from the moment of conception. Mary Rice Hassan, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where she co-founded and directs the Person and Identity Project, joins us now to dive further into the implications of this decision. Mary, welcome back to the show. What does the Supreme Court ruling mean for the national debate on gender transition treatments for minors? Put this week's ruling into context for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I mean, this is a tremendous win. I think it really puts the momentum on the side of those who are trying to protect children. And what this ruling does is it signals to the lower courts, because there are about 27 states that have similar statutes, including Tennessee's, but 27 states. And in many of those states, they have been challenged in court and even enjoined from being enforced. So what this decision says to those lower courts that maybe already entertaining challenges is that these laws should be upheld as an appropriate exercise of the state's authority. The legislature weighed the evidence and concluded these interventions were harmful to children, and so it's perfectly appropriate for the state to regulate medicine in this way.
Mary, in Justice Clarence Thomas's concurrence, he writes in part, quote, this case carries a simple lesson. In politically contentious debates over matters shrouded in scientific uncertainty, courts should not assume that self-described experts are correct. Mary, what is Justice Thomas really saying there, and how consequential is that?
Actually, it was a tremendous point that he made, and he spent a fair amount of time on it. His opinion went through what happens in so-called transition, the evidence related to it. But his real point was this. He was saying to the courts that you should not defer to the experts, so-called experts. He pointed out that many experts have ideological motivations, mm-hmm. but really it's not the role of the courts to weigh the correctness of the experts. That's the role of the legislature, and the courts mm-hmm. need to step back and allow the legislature to do their job.
Mm-hmm. How have those self-described experts responded to what Thomas had to say?
Yeah, it's been disappointing because we have seen over the past couple of years just mounting evidence, particularly from Europe, but even increasingly here in the U.S., study after study showing that these interventions are tremendously harmful to vulnerable young people. Mm-hmm. But instead, right after this decision, within hours, we had a statement from WPATH, which is the transgender lobby organization, from the American Academy of Pediatrics, from the APA, the Psychological Association, saying, basically doubling down and saying, no, we believe these interventions are evidence-based and medically necessary, mm-hmm. even though neither of those two points can be supported by the evidence. And certainly the court's ruling really cast a lot of shade in that direction. Mm-hmm. But there, I think, what they're telling us is that they're committed to the ideology that fuels this, and I think they benefit from the profits that are made from the bodies of very vulnerable young people. Mm.
Mary, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in her concurring opinion, said people who are transgender do not have immutable characteristics. Can you expand on what her point is there?
Yeah, that was a very important point. It actually came out in the oral argument where Justice Alito sort of cornered the ACLU attorney and said, you can't really say this is immutable, right? Because we see detransitioners who, just by the very evidence of their lives, show us that having this feeling of transgender identification doesn't always persist. But it was significant that Justice Barrett really doubled down and analyzed this, because the majority opinion declined to address that question. And so the value of what she did is that her analysis is going to guide the lower courts, because many of them are facing those and called to adjudicate that claim of transgender activists, that transgender status, as they say, it should be a protected characteristic, which means the government would have a much higher burden to show that their law is legitimate. And which her analysis was very clear. She spent a lot of time and went in depth, and she said, when courts have accorded protected status to a particular characteristic like race, they look at things like whether this is innate, whether it's immutable, whether you can define the class of people by this characteristic. And she said the transgender identification, the transgender status, just does not meet those criteria, not one of them. It's not immutable, it's not innate, mm-hmm. and it's really hard to define. Justice Thomas joined her opinion. Justice mm-hmm. Alito agreed in that. He had a slightly different analysis. But that's significant guidance to the lower courts.
Mm. Mary, we are so grateful for your voice on this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
As this court term winds to an end, another big case we are watching is Medina versus Planned Parenthood South Atlantic. The high court's ruling could have national implications on how your taxpayer money is spent. The lawsuit challenges South Carolina's decision to exclude Planned Parenthood from its Medicaid program. And another case of note to be heard during the high court's fall term. Justices have agreed to hear a case involving First Choice Women's Resource Centers, a pro-life pregnancy center in New Jersey. The center is fighting a subpoena from the state attorney general seeking a list of its donors, advertisements, and medical personnel. The attorney general alleges First Choice uses deceptive practices targeting donors and clients. First Choice is a faith-based organization offering free ultrasounds, pregnancy tests, resources, and counseling, and says the subpoena violates its free speech rights. In other major news, a combustible situation in the Middle East continues with a breakout of war between Israel and Iran. Late last week, Israel launched a massive wave of attacks across Iran, bombing nuclear and missile sites and targeting and killing several top military leaders and nuclear scientists. Israel claims it had intelligence Iran was racing to complete a nuclear bomb. Within hours, Iran had launched a counteroffensive of missiles into Israel. Now, a week into the war, destruction and casualties have mounted on both sides. While Israel has continued to target Iranian nuclear sites, scores of civilian buildings have also been hit in both Iran and Israel, including apartment blocks and a major hospital in Israel. Now there is pressure for the U.S. to make a decisive military move to assist the Israeli war effort, because only the U.S. has so-called bunker-busting bombs able to penetrate Iranian nuclear facilities buried deep in a mountain. The Trump administration's decision whether or not to escalate the war is fraught because the risks are so high. A leading nuclear security expert says attacking Iran is like, quote, rolling the nuclear dice and could lead to a catastrophe that military and intelligence officials have been warning about for years, such as
closing the Straits of Hormuz, shutting off, therefore, about a quarter of the world's oil supply. That will sink stock markets around the world, could throw us into a global recession. U.S. bases in the area are going to be attacked. Quds force could start attacking U.S. and Israeli interests outside the region. These people know what they're doing. They can blow up restaurants, blow up symbols of U.S. power. Then at the top of that list of unknowns is that Iran could announce that it has a nuclear weapon and that it has smuggled it into a port of a European ally or of the United States itself and threatened to detonate it unless the U.S. stops its attacks.
On Thursday, the White House announced the president will decide in 2 weeks whether the U.S. will pull the U.S. military into a bombing campaign against Iran. The delay is based on the president's belief negotiations might still work. But in the end, Trump says Iran, quote, just can't have a nuclear weapon. European diplomats are meeting with Iran's foreign minister in Geneva this weekend in hopes of finding a diplomatic solution to the crisis. For analysis of the tensions between Israel and Iran, we are joined by Farhad Rizai. He is a native Iranian, a Christian convert, and former director of Christian Watch on Global Islamism at the Philos Project. He has written extensively about Iran's nuclear program. Thank you for being with us. The threat of war is scary for people on both sides, in both Israel and Iran. Give our viewers some context about Iran, which they may be less familiar with. This week, President Trump posted on Truth Social a stark warning to the people of Tehran, urging residents to immediately evacuate and flee. Tehran has a population of 10 million people. That's bigger than New York City. How did everyday Iranians react to that message from the American president?
Thank you for having me, Catherine. Well, everyday Iranians reacted with alarm. Many of them fled in traffic jams, but there were also people who, there were a kind of defiance on the part of some other people. The Iranian regime also had a response. They dismissed Trump's evacuation call. They called it a psychological warfare from the United States, from the president of the United States. And they tried to, they urged the citizens of Tehran to remain calm. But as far as we know, the regime's modus operandi, they have two kind of goals when they call on Iranian citizens, especially the citizens of Tehran, to remain calm and not to evacuate. Mm. First, they want to use people as human shields. This is actually the tactic that they taught their terror proxies. They taught Hezbollah and Hamas to practice. So that's the first goal. The second goal was to dissuade the Israeli Air Force to dissuade them from targeting the regime bases in Tehran. So that was the reaction from the part of the regime.
Farhad, Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has been in power for more than 35 years. He is the longest serving head of state in the Middle East. The Islamic leader has said Iran has no problem with Jews and Christians, but objects to the country of Israel itself and what he calls Zionist usurpers of Palestine. Iran has supported Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist proxies. Israel claims its attack on Iran are designed to eliminate Iran's ability to launch a nuclear assault on Israel. But given the Ayatollah's hardcore beliefs about Israel, how much does regime change or overthrowing the Ayatollah play into Israel's strategy?
Well, let me tell you first something about the Ayatollah's statement that they have no problem with Jews and Christians. Ask the Iranian Jewish community that how the regime treats them. Ask the Christian community in Iran, and also the Christians in the other part of the Middle East, in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, and Lebanon, that how the regime proxies treated them. As a matter of fact, the Islamic regime in Iran, the IRGC and their terror proxies contributed a great deal of plight to the plight of Christians in the region. So I don't really, care about what Ayatollah says, but care more about what Ayatollah does about Jewish people and the Christian communities, both in Iran and also in the region. Israel has two objectives right now. One is dismantling Iran's nuclear program. This is the first stated goal. And the second goal is to destroy or degrade Iran's missile capabilities. I have never seen any of the Israeli statesmen, any of the Israeli politicians, to say that regime change in Iran is the official policy of the state of Israel. This could be the consequence of the current bombing campaign, but it is not an official policy. So my understanding is that if the Israeli Air Force could dismantle, destroy Iran's nuclear program entirely, and that's including a Fordo site, and also destroy the regime's missile capabilities, I believe that the Israelis would announce those goals are achieved. But then there is one more important issue, and that is Israel now is targeting the bases of the regime that are involved in suppressing Iranian people and Iranian protesters. So if Israel successfully destroy those bases, this will enable Iranian people to come to the street and try to overthrow the regime later. But for now, this is not the stated goal of the state of Israel.
Farhad, we thank you for your expertise on this ongoing story. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine.
As our attention focuses on Israel, Iran, and questions about America's possible involvement, the war is not letting up in Ukraine as Russian missile and drone attacks keep coming. Early this week, Russia struck Kyiv with its deadliest attack this year with a direct missile hit on an apartment building, killing at least 28 people and injuring 140 others. Workers used cranes, excavators, and their hands to clear debris in search of victims buried under the rubble. The overnight attack on sleeping civilians was part of a sweeping Russian barrage trying to overwhelm Ukrainian air defenses. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the site on Thursday to survey the damage and said the carnage is a reminder that Russian President Vladimir Putin continues to reject a ceasefire and peace talks. Zelensky thanked international partners that continue to stand by Ukraine. There is much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
My dear friends, it's a pleasure for me to greet all of you gathered together at White Sox Park.
A message from Leo as Catholics in Chicago turn out en masse to celebrate Dove Hope. We're joined here in studio by renowned author Arthur Brooks to discuss what he calls Pope Leo's mission of love. Later, the surge among young people interested in converting to Catholicism. We talk to two Catholic journalists writing currently about why they say Catholicism is cool. And
the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage continues on the way to Los Angeles, and we have a stop here in Arizona at a historic mission founded by St. Catherine Drexel. We've got that story coming up.
We meet Native American Catholics from the Navajo Nation along the pilgrimage trail who share their unique insights into our faith. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
Chicago celebrated its native son, Pope Leo XIV, last weekend at a special event with Mass at the home stadium of his favorite baseball team.
Oh,
tens of thousands of faithful packed into Wright Field, home of the White Sox, for several hours of testimonials, film presentations, music, and prayer. In a video greeting from Pope Leo himself, he told those gathered he had a special message for America's young people.
You are the promise of hope for so many of us. The world looks to you as you look around yourselves and says, we need you. We want you to come together to share with us in this common mission as church and in the society of announcing a message of true hope and of promoting peace, promoting harmony among all peoples.
And before those gathered proceeded to celebrate Mass, the Pope concluded his video greeting by inviting everyone to open their hearts to God's love, to be generous, and to share what God has given us with others. As Pope Leo XIV navigates the early days of his pontificate, a leading Catholic voice encourages the faithful to take on what he says is the Pope's mission of love. In his popular weekly How to Build a Life column for The Atlantic, social scientist Arthur Brooks writes, as the new Pope charges Catholics to be service missionaries representing a missionary church, then the question is this: what pressing need do we face? Leo named it himself at his inaugural Mass. Brothers and sisters, this is the hour for love. To bind up the wounds in our families, nations, and church is the mission we need today, a mission of true love for a suffering world. But how can a church that's often divided bring about this so-called mission of love to a world in desperate need of it? For that answer and more, we go on the record with the acclaimed author of this piece, one of the most thoughtful voices on what it means to live a good life. And joining us now is Arthur Brooks, columnist for The Atlantic, Harvard professor, and author of the upcoming book, The Happiness Files, Insights on Work and Life. Thank you so much for being here.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you.
It's been just over 1 month now since Pope Leo XIV has been elected.
Amazing.
And you say his mission is a mission of love. What do you mean by that?
Well, we're a missionary church. He reminded us of that in his inaugural, when he came out and introduced himself to the world. You know, his remarks were, we're missionaries with a missionary church. And he, this is a guy with credibility about this. He was a missionary in Peru for a good deal of his career. He truly is a missionary. And he was reminding all of us as Catholics that we're not supposed to sit there and, you know, on our couches. We're supposed to get out in the world. You know, we're a worldly church out there in it, is his whole point. The question then becomes, what kind of missionaries? We're not generally door knockers. Catholics,
right.
Are you not coming on? We're the ones behind the curtain going, pretend we're not home.
Yeah.
But,
guilty.
Well, you know, for sure. But the point is that Catholic missionaries traditionally have been the ones who bring medicine to those who are in need, education for the uneducated, food to the hungry. We are service missionaries. That's the tradition of the Roman Catholic Church, is service missionaries to people who need it. So the question for Pope Leo is, what is the service that the world needs that we can actually serve with our missionary work?
And I want to delve more into that service and that mission. But first, as a social scientist, set the landscape for us.
Yeah.
How is our society doing today? How are us human beings doing in 2025?
Well, you know, we're a fallen lot, of course. And, you know, the truth is that at any given time, you'll find that people think that there's a lot of unhappiness. It's because there is. I mean, life on Earth is a tricky business, to be sure, and we have a challenge to live our best lives and lift other people up and bring them together in bonds of happiness and love. This is the service that we actually have as Christian people. But it looks particularly bad right now. I, as a social scientist, I look at the happiness data going back 30 years, and it's been dropping. It's been dropping pretty gradually almost every year. And then these big storms, you know, the storms of polarization, the storm of screen time with social media, which is horrible for happiness. And then, of course, there was COVID, which led to all kinds of loneliness. So the truth of the matter is that I, as a social scientist, don't like what I'm seeing. But once again, I'm a service missionary. And so my job, not just as a social scientist, more importantly as a Catholic, is to see that as an opportunity to lift people up more and show them not just what they think they want, which is happiness, but what they need, which is the cross and gospel of Jesus Christ.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about some of those practicals of carrying out this mission of love. Some people might equate loving others by showing empathy to others.
Right.
What's your response?
That's not correct. I mean, empathy is, it's a nice emotion. It's kind of a nice thing. And what that really means is feeling the pain of other people.
Right.
There's an old saying that parents often have. You're a new parent, mm-hmm. and you know, you say, and you'll see when your children are of the age where they're having strong emotions, you'll say, you're never happier than your unhappiest child. But that's actually really bad parenting, because nobody wants to have an unhappy parent. Nobody wants to be married to an unhappy person or work for an unhappy person. If we're going to be really good service missionaries in a world lifting people up, we need to work on our own happiness, is the whole point. Mm-hmm. And so empathy of feeling the pain of other people tends to be pretty ineffective. To be a parent of teenagers empathetically or excessively empathetically, or being a boss, that's not the way to do it.
Then what's the healthy approach?
The healthy approach is something that people often mistake for empathy, compassion. Mm-hmm. Compassion is to understand the source of somebody's pain, to really understand it, and then do what needs to be done, even when it's unpopular. You know, I found this as a parent. You know, my kids are grown up now. I have grandkids. Mm-hmm. But when my kids, I had three teenagers at once at one point. It was pretty rough.
God bless you.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, thinking, you know, I feel their pain, but I can't be paralyzed by it. I have to do what needs to be done, and they're not going to like it. And saying, you know, sorry, I know you don't like it, but, you know, I'm not trying to be your friend here. I'm trying to be your dad. Mm-hmm. That's the compassionate thing to do. And that's what the church needs, is to be compassionate, not just empathetic, because there's right and wrong in the world. Hmm. We need to call out what's wrong with love, which is an act of compassion, but we have to do it right.
Yeah. Well, in your piece in The Atlantic, you write, true compassion means speaking forthrightly about faith and morality, and that's where things get even harder. Imparting a difficult truth, as you understand it, to someone when you have no love for them is not hard. Doing it with love is the challenge.
Right.
That point, Arthur, especially resonated with me. I think it's hard for me to speak difficult truths, and here we are in Washington, D.C., a city that frankly runs on division. You spoke about the social science. Gallup says there's a record high of 80% of U.S. adults say Americans are greatly divided on most important values.
Right.
But you are saying it is possible to thread the needle of correcting someone with love.
Yeah, there it is. And the truth of the matter is that you have a moral obligation to call out things that are wrong when they're wrong, for the good of the person, by the way. I mean, we're concerning ourselves with the salvation of souls, and when there's grave sin, we have to call it out. But we will be ineffective in doing so if we don't do that with love. You know, this is what Jesus was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5:44. You've heard that you should love your friends and hate your enemies. But the new teaching is love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's not just the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, the noble thing to do. That's the practical thing to do. If you want somebody to change, and somebody is doing something that's at odds with what you believe, hating them, being contemptuous of them, insulting them, doesn't work. It makes things worse. You've never hated anybody into agreement ever.
1 month in, do you see Pope Leo so far threading this needle?
Oh, it looks so good. I'm so encouraged. I have so much hope and so much optimism about Pope Leo. I mean, his whole approach up to this point, and what do we know about him? We know about him, what he's written and he said when he was the head of the Augustinian Fathers, is just unbelievably loving and nurturing and wise. And at the same time, he's a canon lawyer, so he wasn't watering down anything. This is not a guy who's cutting corners and you know, telling people that it's perfectly okay. On the contrary, what he does is in his career, he's spoken truth in a spirit of love. And that's a lot more of what we all need to emulate as Catholic people.
Speaking more of living in that tension of, you know, standing up for truth, but doing so with love. I mean, you have a best-selling book that you co-wrote with Oprah Winfrey. You work closely with the Dalai Lama, two very famous, influential people who don't share our Catholic faith. Can you speak about what it's been like to collaborate with well-known people on this mission of truth that you're on, with people who don't share our faith?
It's the best thing ever. And the reason it's an incredible opportunity is because I'm a Catholic in that space. You know, this is the mission field that we're in all the time. We should look for places where people don't share our faith. It's good. Like, I get it. Turn on EWTN every day. I do. We all should, because we need our community, to be sure. Right. Go to Mass on Sunday. They're all Catholics in there. It's great. Go to your Bible study. This is really important, but you've got to be out in the world. And you've got to go to the places where you say things people don't expect in a spirit of love. And what are you... At that point, you are the most loving Catholic they've ever met. And that the opportunity to work with somebody as wonderful and as well-known as Oprah Winfrey gave me a platform out in the world that I never would have gotten otherwise. And she was so loving and so wonderful to work with and allowed that. And she wanted me to have that platform, to be sure. But that's what we need to look for. We can't stay insulated. We can't afford it in this world. There's 1.4 billion of us, but there's 8 billion people out there. And we all know, every single person watching EWTN right now knows what the world needs. Mm-hmm. And it's up to us.
Do you think there could be a revival here in the U.S.?
I think it's coming. I mean, when you find this kind of division, when you find this kind of polarization, almost inevitably we're going into a period of greater spiritual enlightenment. Okay. This is coming. The question is, what's the role that the Catholic Church is going to play in the spiritual renewal? And that requires serious missionary work on all of our parts right now. And so we need to ask ourselves tomorrow as we go out, am I being a good missionary or am I not? Mm. Is somebody going to say, I like the way that that person lives their Catholic faith or not? Is that attractive or is that unattractive? Mm. Those are the choices.
Finally, what have you seen so far in the pontificate of Pope Leo XIV that you think we all should emulate so we can carry forward?
It's a good question because it's so new at this particular point. But what I really love is the fact that he is somebody who dedicated himself to taking the faith to the people at the margins of society who actually needed it the most. He never intended to be a bishop, let alone a cardinal and then the Holy Father. I mean, he was selected in this weird serendipitous way. He dedicated his life to being a place where people are forgotten. Going to these particular places and getting little, being small. He's somebody who's been minor over in his entire life. And that's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Is not to puff ourselves up, not to become the most important person in the room, not to be political and actually elbowing other people out of the way. And he was selected. He was elevated on the basis of the fact that he is somebody who, in being small, was identified as somebody who should be emblematic for what we all want to be.
That's a great way to put it and a great reminder for us all. Arthur Brooks, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This update now on a Pope Leo story we brought you last week about the sale of his childhood home in suburban Chicago. The real estate auction to sell the modest brick home in Dalton, Illinois, was supposed to close this past Wednesday, but instead has been extended 1 month until mid-July. The real estate agent says the extension is to allow more time for bidders to review, perform due diligence, and tour the property. The Village of Dalton has already announced it hopes to acquire the home with the support of the Chicago Archdiocese so the public can visit it as a historic site. The current owner, a house flipper, bought the property in 2024 for $66,000 and now stands to make a fortune on his investment. A landmark decision in the British Parliament tops news headlines in the Week in Review. Members of Parliament have voted to decriminalize abortion in England and Wales. Abortion is legal up to 24 weeks in England and Wales, and beyond that, in situations when a mother's life is at risk or there's risk of a serious fetal anomaly. In a landslide vote, 370 to 137 on Tuesday, members of Parliament passed an amendment to prevent women from being arrested, investigated, or prosecuted for terminating the life of their baby at any stage in pregnancy. Parliament members debated for several hours on the amendment.
All this clause looks to do is take out women out of the criminal justice system and give them the support and the help that they need.
This is not about one body. There are two bodies involved. Like it or not, this House has a duty to consider the rights of a woman against the safety and morality of aborting the unborn viable child without consequence. It is not extreme or anti-women to say that a baby matters too.
While women cannot be prosecuted now, medical professionals who aid in abortions after 24 weeks still can be. Conservative lawmakers have warned the amendment is aimed at expanding abortion time limits. The new law still needs to be approved in the House of Lords before it takes effect. On Friday, members of British Parliament narrowly passed an assisted suicide bill.
Terminally ill adults, end-of-life bill.
After months of emotional debates and multiple amendments, the bill passed by just 23 votes. The law would allow terminally ill adults expected to die within 6 months to ask to end their life. It now heads to the House of Lords, where it will face further scrutiny. After a years-long legal battle, New Jersey's Supreme Court determined the state can assemble a grand jury to investigate claims of clergy sexual abuse. Monday's unanimous decision says a lower court erred when it ruled the government could not impanel the jury. The Diocese of Camden has long argued the abuse allegations did not meet the standards for the panel to convene. But in May, Bishop Joseph Williams announced the diocese would no longer oppose the grand jury. In 2022, the diocese agreed to pay some $87 million in abuse settlements, less than 2 years after it filed for bankruptcy. A big development regarding the unrest in Los Angeles over those ICE immigration raids. Mayor Karen Bass lifted the week-long curfew in downtown L.A. on Tuesday as protests and demonstrations decline in the area. The L.A. police chief said his department would maintain a strong police presence downtown to both safeguard property as well as to uphold the right to lawful assembly. In the meantime, on Tuesday, the Trump administration ordered another 2,000 California Army National Guard soldiers to Los Angeles, presumably to help protect federal property and to support ICE agents, even as downtown protests are winding down. Expressing frustration at daily continued ICE arrests at workplaces, homes, and off the street, some protesters are mounting what they are calling No Sleep for ICE demonstrations outside of suburban LA hotels where ICE agents are staying. Honking car horns, playing music, and blowing noisemakers, the protesters are being permitted to congregate, with suburban police looking on to make sure the situation remains peaceful. Hundreds gathered outside Minnesota's Capitol Wednesday for a vigil to remember a Catholic and prominent state lawmaker and her husband gunned down in their home last Saturday morning. 57-year-old Vance Bolter is accused in the deadly shooting of Democratic State Representative and former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark. Authorities say he also shot and wounded another Democrat, State Senator John Hoffman, and his wife Yvette. Investigators say Bolter also went to two other lawmakers' homes that night. One target wasn't there, and police showed up at the others, so he fled. Bolter surrendered Sunday night after what authorities have called the largest manhunt in state history. In Washington, members of Congress say the deadly shootings have renewed concerns about their security and even threats facing their families. According to U.S. Capitol Police, the number of threat cases has climbed for a second year in a row. In 2024, a special unit investigated more than 9,400 direct threats against members of Congress, including their families and staff. Coming next, Trending Catholic. We explore what that means with two leading Catholic journalists. We will ask just that. Why? Right after this. From the air of mystery associated with a papal conclave that intrigued the world to the media still buzzing about the first U.S.-born pope, the scent of chrism oil seems to be everywhere in 2025. In this Catholic Life segment, we look at how our faith is so on trend this year. Adult baptisms are booming this year. U.S. Catholic dioceses are reporting a surge in converts across the country, a 50% year-over-year increase in Cleveland, Ohio, a 67% bump in Winona, Rochester, Minnesota. These Catholic conversions are universal. In France, the French Bishops Conference reported a 45% uptick in adult converts at Easter 2025. And just this month, a record 19,000 people, mostly young, traveled on the 43rd annual Chartres pilgrimage, a three-day journey from Paris to Chartres, France. Kazakhstan's Bishop Athanasius Schneider was there.
It was the most high participation in all history of 40 years.
With the death of Pope Francis in late April, our culture went from being obsessed with the Oscar-winning movie Conclave to then watching the real thing unfold in Rome, or at least what we could watch. Global searches for how to become Catholic surged by a staggering 373% between April 20th and April 26th.
And then this moment.
Habemus Papam.
Since taking the chair of St. Peter, Pope Leo XIV has been enjoying a warm embrace from the media.
Catholicism's having a moment.
SiriusXM, the Catholic Channel host Katie McGrady, says Leo fever has hit the U.S. in particular.
But the American of it all is that he's one of us. He might do for America what J.P. Du did for Poland, which was this revival of excitement and joy and pride in our Catholicism.
Whether you're looking at the sign of the times or even a recent cover of Time magazine, the countercultural Catholic Church is being embraced by our culture for now.
To delve into this perceived revival of Catholicism, we're joined by two Catholic journalists who've been tracking these trends as well. Christine Emba is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Her work's focus includes looking at youth culture and social norms. She's also a contributing writer at the New York Times. Madeline Kearns is an associate editor at the Free Press and recently dove into this topic with her article, How Catholicism Got Cool. Well, let's start there. Let's start with this question for you both. Is Catholicism cool right now? What are you observing? Maddie, I'll go to you first.
So if by cool we mean something that young people are very interested in, then absolutely. And this is borne out by the data that you just mentioned in your introduction, but also anecdotally priests are saying that not only are they seeing an uptick in baptisms, but actually they're seeing an uptick in youth participation and youth baptisms in particular. I think this has been noted as a general trend in men, young men becoming more interested in Christianity. But what's interesting is the kind of conventional wisdom around this is that young people become less religious, even those who are raised in the faith, they become less religious. And then maybe later in life, when they marry and they settle down, they come back to church. Whereas what we're seeing here is actually young people who maybe don't come from any religious background or certainly not a very committed one, seeking out Catholicism and becoming very committed themselves and sometimes becoming more Catholic and practicing their faith than even their parents. And that can be a kind of odd reversal of the presumed social norm.
Christine, what's your reaction to the question on whether Catholicism is cool right now?
You know, there is the question of just whether it's gaining in, you know, cultural relevance among young people. And that is certainly true. I mean, as the data that you guys just showed will tell us. But I actually do think that Catholicism is becoming kind of cool, period, in that it is a cultural trend that's being embraced by kind of cultural forerunners. You know, you're seeing, first of all, just in this moment, a fascination with aesthetics, the look of things, and also a tiredness with the digital realm, with being on social media, with sort of seeing things online among young people. And one thing that is very true about Catholicism is that it is incredibly embodied. So, you know, the ritual, the Eucharist, the going to church, the icons, they're all sort of right there and visible, which is attractive. And then, of course, the aesthetic. I mean, one of my favorite tweets during the conclave was that, you know, if you're looking at two cardinals in full regalia, like hanging out together in front of a basilica, like that just looks cooler than any service that you're going to see anywhere else. And so that's kind of attractive to young people who are so interested in visual things right now.
I spoke with Catholic radio host and author Katie McGrady about what she's observing when it comes to young people in particular being drawn to the faith. Here's part of what she told me.
In this incredibly relativistic society where do anything you want as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else has been tried and found wanting by young people. The church has something deeper and better than the constant scroll or wishy-washy morals. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. The church should be capitalizing on that at this moment.
Maddie, let's stick to this theme here. What do we know about young people in particular flocking to the church right now and why?
Well, certainly I think there is an emphasis on traditionalism. And I don't necessarily mean the traditional Latin Mass, which is what people assume you mean when you say that, but rather Orthodox teachings, morals, the challenge of Catholicism, the challenge of being very different from what secular culture offers. And certainly one thing that struck me was that the young people I was speaking to for this article were telling me things such as, I went and tried other forms of Christianity, but it was too it was too wishy-washy, or one young man said, oh, it felt like I was at a concert. Whereas when I'm in the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm there for God. I'm there to worship. Mm-hmm. One mentioned the role of silence in the Catholic liturgy, or mm-hmm. another actually mentioned the role of Gregorian chant and sort of feeling transported. Mm-hmm. So certainly there's a real hunger for the transcendent.
Christine, is there a gender gap when it comes to these Catholicism trends that we're seeing? What role are men playing in particular right now?
So as a general rule, well, not as a general rule, actually, in the last Pew Religious Values survey, we saw a kind of surprising leveling off of the number of people, including young people who are leaving Christianity. But when we look at who is returning to the church or even converting to Catholicism or other forms of Christianity right now, we are seeing a surge in young men, and young men are also tending to join sort of more conservative or orthodox either religions or congregations, including sort of more traditionalist, which again mm-hmm. is not necessarily to say traditional Latin Mass, mm-hmm. But sort of traditional or traditionalist parishes. And, you know, we don't know exactly why, but there are a couple theories that I would put forth. Mm-hmm. One is that, I think as we've been talking about, there is a sense of a loss of norms in a moment in which everything seems up for grabs, including sort of what you worship, what your gender is, what your sexuality is. And this is true, I think, for men in particular, who seem to be struggling in this moment with definitions of what is masculinity? What does it mean to be a man? The Catholic Church has really defined and clear and historical roles when it comes to gender and sex. And I think a lot of young men are drawn to a space where they feel that there is space made for them to be a man, that there is a specific role, that of the priest, the father, that men play in the Catholic faith. But we are also just seeing young men returning to faith broadly more often than women are. And again, there's also some pushback from women who feel particularly ostracized or marginalized when they think about church teaching on sex, recent rulings on abortion. And so men don't seem as bothered by some of those things and I think are thus more willing to return.
It's been just over a month now since Pope Leo's election, so it is too early to see actual data on whether this Leo fever is resulting in more converts. But is Pope Leo making Catholicism more mainstream right now? Christine, your thoughts?
Well, we just saw, you know, that picture of him in the Sox hat that went viral just a few days ago. But I think that Americans especially are excited by the idea of an American pope. And frankly, because Pope Leo is new and we're still sort of learning his position on a number of things, he is proving, at least at this moment, to be a somewhat less polarizing figure than Pope Francis turned out to be among especially more, again, traditional Catholics in the U.S. So for now, at least, it does seem that Pope Leo is drawing interest as people watch the conclave, as people are sort of tying him to his native Chicago and not causing division.
Maddie, what are your thoughts on how Pope Leo factors into all of this?
Yeah, I would agree very strongly with everything Christine just said. I think also there was such with under Francis, there was such confusion, and I don't blame that all on Francis. I mean, part of it is, of course, things get lost in translation. And to have a pope who speaks English, natively speaks English, is going to be a very interesting thing in itself. I mean, just for him to have given addresses in English, and of course he's fluent in multiple languages, I think that's going to bring some much needed clarity. He does also seem just temperamentally a bit more reserved than Francis, a bit more moderate, perhaps, at least in his temperament. And I think these are all strengths, again, given that the context that we're dealing with right now is a very polarized, divided church.
And Maddie, finally, there's still a lot of buzz about whether we are on the brink of a religious revival, particularly here in the U.S. Meanwhile, this very weekend, the U.S. Bishop's 3-year National Eucharistic Revival comes to its official end. Are there any parallels that you see there?
Yeah, so certainly, I mean, the broad story of religion in America is, of course, one of decline. And I don't think that's necessarily completely changed by these promising developments. But certainly within the cohort who are going to church, we are seeing this revival, this renewal of interest, and especially among the young, which is very positive. Gen Z are the latest the only generation in the last four or five to be not declining further in religiosity than the previous one, which is certainly a very promising trend. In terms of the Eucharistic revival, I certainly think there's a parallel in the sense that some of the converts I was speaking to were talking about, you know, why Catholicism in particular, as opposed to other denominations, and they were citing the Eucharist and the sacramental life of the church as a reason, as something that made Catholicism distinct. So certainly we can see that trend there.
There is so much more I would love to discuss, but we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you both for your very thoughtful analysis.
Thank you so much for having me.
That the Lord is real. He is here among us. You know, just really grateful for that.
A member of the Navajo Nation expresses her strong Catholic faith as the celebration of the true presence in the Eucharist comes to her home in Arizona. The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage stop at America's largest Native American reservation was perhaps one of the most unique destinations along the St. Catherine Drexel route. It comes as the pilgrimage nears its end, winding through 10 states and across more than 3,000 miles from Indianapolis to Los Angeles. Reporter Mark Irons rejoined the route along the Arizona-New Mexico border.
Verna Carty says Navajo traditions helped her appreciate this mystery of Catholic faith, that Christ is fully present in the Eucharist under the appearance of bread.
We understand when they say there's a being in this host and this Eucharist, and that there is a vibrant of grace that comes out of it.
The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage departed from Indianapolis in May. The route is named after St. Catherine Drexel, a great American saint who traveled all over the U.S. spreading the gospel. Like Drexel herself, those on pilgrimage have covered thousands of miles with stops all along the way to Los Angeles.
You kind of have this beautiful image of Jesus himself went out into the desert.
But this remote stop stands out.
And I think that's what Jesus in the Eucharist is doing. He's coming to the people in the desert.
Surrounded by rustic beauty in the northeast corner of Arizona, this is home for many Native Americans. The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage has traveled along many roads, bringing Christ to cities, states, and towns. But this is a nation, and the Navajo people have a heritage of their own. And there's a history of faith here, which has touched many aspects of life. Named after a towering red sandstone landmark, this town near the Arizona-New Mexico border is called Window Rock. It's the capital of Navajo Nation, the largest Native American reservation in the U.S. A short drive from Window Rock, under the hot desert sun, there's a spiritual oasis.
Hello.
Yadeh means welcome, and it also means everything is good. That's what Yadeh means.
Yadeh. Welcome.
Verna is the curator of this small museum. It's housed in the original building of St. Michael's Mission, established in 1898 to minister to the Navajo people.
I really cherish the church. They do not push us away with our culture.
It's fitting that the pilgrimage would stop here. This mission was founded by St. Catherine Drexel, who spent her life serving the marginalized of society, African-American and Native American communities. St. Michael Indian School still thrives on the grounds, and it's from the school chapel where Eucharistic procession ventured out onto this dirt road.
In Navajo, we say Diyin, that's Jesus' name.
Laverne Joe went to St. Michael Indian School as a young girl. It's moving to have this national pilgrimage pass through Navajo Nation.
It's just really special.
She walked in the procession, a half mile or so from the school to the Mission Church, Mary Mother of Mankind, where years ago she first received Jesus in the Eucharist.
And I received my communion here. My brothers got married here, and it's a family ground here for us.
Another reason this is all so special, her grandfather always reminded her to keep the faith, to march with Christ.
My grandfather told us to march with him, and that's one of the things he told us, you know, not to leave the Catholic Church.
After the March with Jesus, Eucharistic adoration followed inside this mission church, built with local stones gathered years ago by Navajo men like Laverne's grandfather. A firm foundation lives on. And the story of St. Catherine Drexel inspires Ace Acuna, who has traveled with the pilgrimage from the start.
Her love for the Eucharist is what drove her to come out here and forsake everything.
Francis Weber is also among the small group of young adults, the perpetual pilgrims, who have packed into this van for the entire journey.
This is like what we as pilgrims like love to do. We just like want to be with the people, really.
Following Eucharistic adoration and opportunities for confession, a potluck meal gathered more people together, a chance to eat and share. For the pilgrims, moments like this are meaningful as they encounter the rich diversity of the church across America.
We want to meet them. We want to like get to know them, hear their stories, and like, yeah, just like encounter them where they're at and let the Lord encounter us through them.
What made you think, I'm going to start looking into faith?
Cason Lester is a recent convert to Catholicism. His spiritual journey began when he sought to overcome the anxiety he struggled with.
I looked towards religion, and at first it was just, you know, my own culture, my own Navajo religion, and it gave me some sort of peace, but not all of it. And so I looked into Christianity.
What have you found in the Catholic Church that you didn't find in other forms of spirituality?
Beauty, reverence, tradition. I guess just our Lord, just like in the most authentic form.
This two-day pilgrimage stop at St. Michael's Mission ended with Mass celebrated by Bishop James Wall, who leads the Diocese of Gallup, the poorest diocese in the U.S. Mary, Mother of Mankind, is just one church in this expansive diocese, which covers 55,000 square miles of ground in both Arizona and New Mexico, and meets the needs of many Native American communities to this day. For anyone who has been far from faith or struggles with anxiety, questions, doubts, Cason offers an invitation to come and see.
You're loved. You're appreciated. Jesus is there. He loves you.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
This weekend, the three-year National Eucharistic Revival will come to an end when the Eucharistic Pilgrimage Trail reaches its final destination in Los Angeles. EWTN News will be there.
I'm Montse Alvarado on the Camino de California, on our way to L.A. And behind me, you see over 1,000 pilgrims who followed our Lord in the Eucharist through this Drexel route to adore our Lord and bring him here to Christ Cathedral. That will be the culmination of the National Eucharistic Revival, the end but the beginning of the fire that is spreading. We'll have that report for you next week on EWTN News in Depth.
And that's it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again next week. But until then, God bless.